22-5005 U.S. v. Walker.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Donnelly and I represent the appellant Amanda Walker. As the court is aware, the co-defendants in this case and the next have combined some of the issues. I will be relying on Mr. Morrison's counsel to argue the issues that have been briefed by him. I'm planning to address three of the issues that we have briefed, the constitutional challenge to the Oklahoma statute, the Apprendi issue, and the defect in the jury instructions, all of which do comply with the standards for plain review, and each of which would be an independent reason for reversal in this case. As to the first issue, the constitutional challenge, as the court has observed, this is a very unique and unusual statute.
Well, I don't find it that unique when you look at the Oklahoma statutes, and I was sort of surprised that neither of the parties noticed that Oklahoma has a definition in its criminal code of what constitutes a felony. And any crime which may be punishable by death or imprisonment in the penitentiary is a felony, not a misdemeanor. And section 843.5B is punishable by imprisonment, not exceeding life imprisonment. And the Oklahoma court and this court have both interpreted similar statutes as being a felony and not a misdemeanor. So I'm a little surprised that we're not looking at Oklahoma's definition of felony here, but I don't see that this statute could be a misdemeanor.
Your Honor, great point. To add to that.
Thank you.
Of course, anything that you say is a great point. I should have known not to start with that sentence, but there's also a definition for misdemeanor in the statute.
Well, and a misdemeanor is anything that's not a felony.
But more importantly, for the specific reason that you have brought the issue to your attention. So the language in 843.5 talks about two separate phases, right? So you have, specifically the statute counts, uses the term county jail. So it says that abuse can be, one,
right,
punished by maximum of 1 year in county jail.
Or
up
to life imprisonment in the state penitentiary.
Exactly. So the first part goes to Your Honor's point. It goes to the definition of the felony, but
the definition in Oklahoma of the felony is any crime that may be punishable by being in the state penitentiary. And the Oklahoma courts and this court have said that it's what you might be charged with, not the lower. And so if it can be either, it's a felony, not a misdemeanor. And it simply gives discretion to the sentencing court, broad discretion, of how much to sentence them to and whether to send them to jail or prison. But it doesn't change the fact that under Oklahoma law and our interpretation of Oklahoma law, that this is a felony.
Your Honor, I completely understand the argument. I completely understand the argument that the statute does allow charging for a felony, which is exactly on point. There is unfettered discretion for the prosecution to choose. And that is our problem.
There is an unfettered discretion to choose whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. It is a felony under Oklahoma law. There is unfettered discretion in the court sentencing of whether they want to send them to jail or prison, but the Supreme Court has said that's fine. So, I think this question has been answered by Oklahoma and by this court, that when you look, Oklahoma law holds that is the potential punishment, not the actual punishment, that is used to determine whether a conviction is a felony. And so if it is a potential to be in the state penitentiary, it is by definition of Oklahoma law a felony.
So I understand that Your Honor's interpretation would give us the result that any act of child abuse, regardless of its severity, is punishable by felony, that we should completely disregard the misdemeanor language, which is consistent with Section 10 of the Oklahoma statute under Title 21 that defines the misdemeanor as a crime punishable by maximum 1 year in county jail. And that language exists in 843.5, and this interpretation would require us to completely ignore that portion of the statutory language. And it will not get rid of the substantive problem. As this court has said in the past, I believe actually that was Your Honor's opinion recently in granting the certificate of appealability, where Your Honor cites to the LA language that raises the issue that any time that you have something with this wide range, if you are going to use a factor as aggravating factor, you should submit that to the jury. And that takes me to my second argument, that but the interplay of all of
so these, you switch right? to your Aileen argument
so, not now. Yet oh. Because I'm submit to the court that there's an interplay between all of these arguments because of the constitutional vague language of the statute. The problem is that you have a statute that without providing any element that goes to the mens rea, any element that discusses the level of injury caused, provides literally an, the most broad possibility for the prosecution to choose. So if you have, and the language says child abuse is defined in the most general terms. It does not go to the severity, just says if the child has been abused, right? And in that scenario, so the prosecution can choose if you have the most minor acts of child abuse. By your interpretation, we would get to a potential life sentence and give that latitude to the prosecution and to the court to sentence to that without having anything intervening in between to tell us what is the guidance, which, as you see, actually was the prosecution's problem, because we do train our U.S. attorneys to be very focused on the integrity of the system. So why did they have to file that motion for an upward variant? It was a recognition of the fact that this statute is unconstitutionally vague. They need a direction to come to the court and argue that the facts of this case, because we have serious bodily injury, you have to go upward. If your analysis is consistent with our interpretation of Oklahoma law, and I don't know what the issue has been because I haven't been directed as to a specific case, but I would guess that this issue has not been before the court because we haven't seen it before.
Well, how would your argument differ if the statute, the Oklahoma statute, said nothing about up to a year of imprisonment in county jail? There would still be the range of possible imprisonment from 1 day to life. Why is that not unconstitutionally vague?
It is. I was submitting
so this so any so any set any statute that has a long range of sentence is unconstitutionally vague. You have to have sentencing guidelines, and they have to be mandatory guidelines to satisfy constitutional due process. Is that what you're saying? Because there's no precedent for that.
I would submit to the court that there is precedent for that. If we look at the Apprendi footnote 16, Apprendi specifically addresses that if you have a statute, and I'm not just focusing on the sentencing, just so I can explain to the court, that the issue is if you have factors that are so fundamental that a state, and I'm quoting now at this point, certain factors are so fundamental that a state could not, as a substantive matter, refrain from recognizing them so long as it chooses to punish given conduct as a crime. These are so fundamental, and as you see, I provided the court a comparison between Colorado and Oklahoma statute to see that the level of specificity that you know exactly what you're looking for as a mens rea, and what I quoted to the court is footnote 13.
And how many statutes have fallen as a result of the principles stated in that footnote?
Unfortunately, I don't have the statistics on that, Your Honor, but
I don't need statistics. I just need one case. So I don't think there's any support for that.
Your Honor, actually, they support footnote 16 in Apprendi cites to Patterson.
Okay, those are the cases involving murder where the question was whether the defendant had the burden of establishing that it was just manslaughter, something along those lines. Aren't those the cases?
And Patterson was
as close to overruled as could be 2 years later by the Supreme Court, but it hasn't been expressly overruled. But that's not what we have here.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that Patterson was not mentioned in Allen, but let's talk about what Allen says.
What Allen says is that if it is an increase in the mandatory minimum, the statutory mandatory minimum, then you've got a constitutional problem. We don't have that here. And if you look at Apprendi, it's talking about if it's above the statutory maximum. We don't have that here. So we don't have an Allen or an Apprendi problem here. Well, neither of those cases help you.
I understand, Your Honor. If you completely ignore the existence of the specific language in the statute that says this crime can be punishable by a maximum of 1 year in county jail, we could reach that result. But that would require that we completely ignore the statutory language.
Well, the Supreme Court in Beckles has said that there's no problem with giving a sentencing court broad discretion to sentence. We don't have a problem with that so long as the parameters are not unclear. Here the parameters are clear. You can do less than a year in the county jail, you can give them life. And the district court, the sentencing court, can look at all of the factors of the sentencing factors and decide where in that range they want to put it. But I don't know that there's any Supreme Court authority that says they can't do that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I see that my time is up. I have only 2 minutes. I would like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Well, you're not going to be able to raise a new issue on rebuttal. You can't reserve an issue and then say, I'll talk about rebuttal. That's not fair to the appellee. So if you're going to give up arguing anything but the vagueness issue, that's fine. But you're not going to be allowed to raise another issue.
The course direction, I can continue. I thought that I have already raised a friendly, but the only issue that is left is the jury instruction. Okay. I will reach that if the court
wish
to hear from me again.
You can use your time as you wish, but you can't raise and rebuttal something that you did not address in your opening.
I understand. Minutes or
2 minutes, because we talked.
May it please the court, my name is Chantel Dial and I represent the United States. I'd like to quickly respond to just a couple of things that counsel said. First, that the Oklahoma statute doesn't provide a mens rea. That's incorrect for both of these. Both require willful or malicious. So that issue of constitutionality is not at play here. There is a mens rea. And then also it was suggested that the government had to file a variance because the statute punishment was vague. The government filed a variance request because we were dealing with analogous federal guidelines and there was no on-point federal guideline. And that was the purpose for raising or for filing a variance motion. As to the remainder of the constitutional challenges, I wish I had looked at the felony definition, and that was an error not seeing that. Based on what the court has said, government would agree that the Oklahoma statute is a felony. Even if not, the test that the appellant asks this court to consider compares it more to Colorado statute, which is not the test. It's not whether or not it's as thorough as another statute. It's whether or not it's constitutional on its face and as applied. The only other specific thing. I believe that the allocution errors are probably going to be discussed more in the next hearing. But for the record, I wanted to point out the record site specific to Walker that I think is important in considering any allocution concerns. And that is that if this court is at all concerned about Walker's apparent abandonment of her downward variance request in light of the court's suggestions that it might not be granted, I wanted to point out that on record volume 3 at 588, the defendant through counsel actually suggests that she intends to abandon the downward variance request only after the court had ruled on PSR objections. So before the court even got to any variance or not variance discussion, the defendant had already said that through counsel that she was not going to be asking for the downward variance.
Would you agree it was error to announce before allocution that I'm not going to grant a downward variance?
It wasn't a definitive statement.
Well, but it was a definitive statement that I don't have any interest in hearing arguments on that topic. And we have case law that says allocution can be on any topic, and if you limit what they can say on allocution, it's error.
Here, I don't believe that the district court did limit that. That would be error.
Well, the district court said, I'm not going to grant a downward variance.
Correct, but that's different from Jarvie, where the district court prohibited the defendant from still talking about a downward variance.
Well, don't you think it's an implied prohibition? I've already denied it, but I'm going to use my allocution to argue it.
Yes, it could be, Your Honor, which is part of why I point out that record site, because perhaps this is like Jimenez, where the district court's statements implicitly limited the scope, like in Jimenez. But I think that's why the record here is so important, because actually the defendant suggests that she's limiting herself before the court even gets to its rulings or thoughts on the downward variance. She limits her variance through counsel just after the court ruled on the objections to the PSR on 588. So because of that, it's distinguishable from Jimenez, where the defendants seem to change their request based on the court's ruling on the variance. If, however, the court does find that the district court's statements did implicitly limit, this is more akin to Jimenez, where it still isn't plain error, because it still wasn't a definitive announcement that clearly and unambiguously communicated a specific sentence. The court has said that it would not grant a downward variance. It said that it didn't find the guidelines, or it found the guidelines inapplicable or inadequate, but then it lays out that the sentence would be the high end 57 months up to life. So there's a wide range that the court could choose from there.
So how's an error going to be even preserved in this context when you have the judge say, I'm not interested in hearing argument about any variance, any downward variance, and I'm going to deny any motion for downward variance? And then at the very end of the process, before the actual sentence is announced, the judge says, oh, by the way, would you like to allocute? What happens then? Oh, objection, Your Honor. You've already violated my client's rights by announcing your sentence and telling her that anything she wanted to say wouldn't be considered. I mean, how's that work? I mean, is it really something that's viewed in the plain error realm, or?
Well, this court has consistently reviewed these issues in plain error, and Slinkard and Jimenez and the cases cited in both of those. And respectfully, here, Your Honor, the court did not say that it wasn't interested in hearing a downward variance, or it didn't say that the defendant couldn't talk about Dillinger, except it didn't find it applicable. So the plain error standard review is the one that's been consistently applied.
Fair enough. I was just thinking out loud because I look at these things and I'm like, how is this objection actually going to come up? But you go on. Don't get caught up on this one.
What about Jimenez? Doesn't it make it clearly established? I mean, it goes through and says you limited them. This was inappropriate.
Implicitly, yes. The decision in Jimenez is that the court's statements implicitly limited the defendant by saying that it
right.
was going to. And so I think, yes, the court here could find that the district court's statements implicitly limited the defendant. That kind of goes to my point of she.
Well, and then it's plain because we already said that in Jimenez.
Respectfully, no. In Jimenez, it wasn't plain error. It was.
Right.
It was error.
Yes.
It was decided before this allocution issue, right?
I'm not sure I understand that Jimenez came after this allocution.
Okay, I'm confused
on
timing.
Plain error is determined by the law at the time the appellate court decides.
That's right.
So if we have a precedent saying this was error, then it's plain error for any case we hear after that point, no matter when the allocution took place.
Yes,
okay.
I completely agree. Maybe
So are you conceding? I thought you were conceding that under Jimenez, there was an error here.
Yes, the government is conceding that under Jimenez, there is error. But like Jimenez, it is not plain error because there was not a definitive statement. This court said in Jimenez.
Well, but Jimenez, if we get the benefit of Jimenez, Jimenez says where it's implicit, it's error. So now we have law that says plainly that if you implicitly foreclose an argument during allocution, it's error.
Respectfully, no. Jimenez lays out three ways that it is plain error. First, that it's a total denial of allocution. We don't have that here. Second, an express limitation on allocution. That's not present either. And then third, a definitive statement of a sentence to be imposed. That's slingered. Jimenez talks about how the court saying that a guideline sentence implicitly limited the defendant but was not plain error because it was not a definitive statement.
But the question is, it wasn't plain when Jimenez was decided. So the issue is, was it plain after Jimenez was decided, which turns on whether Jimenez decided that it was in fact error. And I think not to spot you, give you a softball, but they assumed without deciding in Jimenez that it was error, which means that it doesn't establish plain error here. But if they had, it would be plain here.
Well, and that's why the record, I think, is important in that she had changed her request before the court even got to that variance. I believe I understand what the court is asking, but
if they had in Jimenez found that implicitly foreclosing an area to allocution is error, we would have plain error here, is what I think the court is agreed on.
Okay.
Judge Hartz.
Have I ever disagreed with you?
Yes.
If the court were to adopt such a rule that even an implicit limitation is plain error, that is creating a rule that actually gives defendants less information. So what we're dealing with here, I understand what the court's saying, that after Jimenez, then it's plain error. the allocution.
Well, it might be. It depends what Jimenez said.
And Jimenez said that plain error occurs with a definitive statement. A rule saying that implicit limitations as
it's not what Jimenez said. Jimenez said, you know what, this was a limitation on the scope of allocution, and that's problematic. And we are, for purposes of our analysis, going to assume without deciding that that was error. But it's not plain because we haven't decided it before. That's what Jimenez said.
If the court were to adopt a rule that any statement that even implicitly limited was plain error, that would actually provide defendants with less information before allocution. The court giving the defendant an idea of where it's headed and saying that the guidelines aren't going to be applicable provides the defendant with an opportunity to address where the court's coming from. Otherwise, the rule that we're looking at is that a defendant gets up and says everything that he has to say, having no idea that the district court is not intending to go below.
In this case, that's not really what you have, because after going on for several pages, the court says, for the reasons articulated and to reflect the seriousness of this offense, this is all pre-allocution, promote respect for the law and provide just punishment, blah, 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 the court finds that an upward variance is warranted in this case. A sentence greater than the imprisonment range identified by the advisory guidelines is reasonable and sufficient, and it goes through the magic language there. And then it says, Mr. Morrison, I bounced over to Morrison. Do you wish to make a statement? So I guess I don't have you on that one.
Well, but the court does say that it's going to grant an upward variance. And effectively, before allocution, effectively the court gives the defendant an idea, and it's on record volume 3, Your Honor, for Walker at 592. The court does say that it's convinced a sentence within the guideline range would be woefully inadequate. But then it goes on to say that the guidelines are 46 to 57 months, but the max is life, and that it's going to grant an upward variance, giving the defendant an opportunity to know that the court is considering a sentence between an upward variance between 57 months to life, and then allowing the defendant to be able to respond to knowing more of what the court is looking at.
So, never mind. Go ahead. Go ahead and finish. We don't have enough time.
Actually, my time's up, so if there are any further questions, the government would just ask to affirm.
Ms. Donnelly, since counsel for the government addressed allocution, it's fair game. But I was just looking at your brief. Did you argue allocution in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor. We adopted the argument made in Morrison.
How can you do that when it's a different factual situation?
It is identical. Actually, Judge Carson, you're right. You had the prosecution on page 593. It is the exact same thing happening. The judge specifically says that the government's motion at docket number 78 is granted. Then it goes ahead and says, Ms. Walker, do you have something to say? So as the allocation, we have preserved that issue by adopting the Morrison's approach. It was exactly the identical situation. The court makes a ruling. Then it says, hey, Ms. Walker, do you have something to say?
Tell me where in your brief.
They don't actually, other than saying they adopt the Morrison brief, they don't specifically make any argument.
It is the identical argument, Your Honor.
Where do you say you adopt?
In our opening brief, at the last page of the opening brief.
The last page?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
And the reply the same. As to the argument that I wanted to focus on, the apprendee issue, which I did raise during the opening, I wanted to make sure that this is on the record, that we are preserving the apprendee issue, both when it is inside and outside the statutory authorized range. As to the inside the statute, the outside the statutory authorized range, because the argument is that this is so standardless that there is no distinction between the felony and misdemeanor, and we know that in count two, you have action conduct that, based on the missing definition in the Oklahoma statute that specifically says disciplining your child is not abuse, that in order to move to something to 10 year, the court had to make a finding as to the aggravated factor, which was the seriousness of the crime, which was not submitted to the jury. And based on Allen at page 114, there was a must. It should have been submitted to the jury. And as to the argument for even application of it within the range, you have Justice Scalia's dissent in Sabian-Omana that is actually in conformity with Justice Gorsuch's opinion from the 10th Circuit, both of whom have made a point that even when it is within the statutory, when you are dealing with factors that are so important, that are so embedded in the definitional piece, the elemental piece of the crime, that they should be submitted to the jury.